Hey, Reset listeners, I've got something super special for you. So, it's been a year of us all being stuck inside, and I think it is not a better time to reset, which is why I am so excited to announce a partnership with the Miraval Berkshires, which is a one-of-a-kind spa in Lenox, Massachusetts. Basically, we're launching the Reset Weekend. April 30th to May 2nd, we're creating an amazing weekend where you can go, relax, get spa treatments, hike, sit by the pool, get every massage you could ever dream of in a one-of-a-kind, amazing space. I had the honor of going to this space back last summer, and it fueled my soul. And I think once you spend a weekend at Miraval, you're going to love it. So I'd love for you to join me on April 30th to May the 2nd for a Reset Weekend. Details are in the show notes, and come on through and check out Miraval Berkshires.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Reset Podcast. I'm your host, Laura Mignot, CEO of the Cultural Communications Agency, Declanche. Each episode, I bring on a different business leader who's doing some game-changing work. And this episode, I am so excited to have Matt Blumberg, who's the founder and CEO of Bolster, a really innovative tech company that's going to help diversify board seats and so much more. It's going to be a great conversation. Take a listen. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Laura, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Good to see you, even though we're in the virtual universe that we all have been in for the last year. even though we are still stuck at home, the podcast remains the same. The first question is always still the same. So, Matt, what was your first job?
My first job after college was as a management consultant. Your sort of basic entry-level analyst job at a firm. When I was hired there, it was called Strategic Planning Associates. It became Mercer Management Consulting and is now called Oliver Wyman. That was job one for a couple of years out of college. And it was a great entry point to the world of business. It was a grind, it was sort of 80 plus hour week, but incredible learning. It was a job that I always say I probably would have paid someone for the opportunity, although I'm glad I didn't have to.
And so was this the type of management consulting gig where you were on a plane every other week?
At least, more like every Monday to Thursday. Lots of hours logged in lots and lots of places.
Oh yeah. I've had a number of friends who have lived that life, and then you see them, I'm like, why do you look like you've aged 10 years? Like, I live on a plane. I'm like, I get it. So cool. So you learned lots of really important things about customers and clients and also business travel, and probably had a suitcase really well.
Yeah, a lot of things about presenting and how to communicate and get your point across, a lot of analytic techniques, a lot of problem solving, and a lot of different industries. You work in really intensely on one project for 3 months or 4 months, and then you're on to the next one. And it's just a great way to get kind of an overview of the world of business.
Awesome. All right. So we go from doing management consulting to now founding Bolster. What was that career journey like?
Well, there were a couple things in between, if you want to hear about those.
Yeah, go for it.
So from consulting, I went into the venture capital business and worked for a couple of years at a firm called General Atlantic Partners. And that's where I really, got the bug about tech and startups. 1994, 1995 was pretty, sort of early, very, very early for the commercial internet. But the firm when I was there was making venture investments in companies like Priceline and E-Trade, sort of in the very early days of the internet. And I went to work from there. I joined a company that was headquartered in New York. It was a small cap public company called MoviePhone. For anyone that's been in New York or LA or other big cities, you might remember 777 Film and that kind of kooky voice. Hello and welcome to MoviePhone.
Uh-huh.
And the guys at MoviePhone hired me to kind of figure out what the what this sort of nascent internet thing was, and how to build the movie phone telephone application online. So that's really where I spent, you know, sort of what people now call Internet 1.0 of 95, 6, 7, 8, 9, building and running the movie phone online business until we, until we sold the company to AOL, which was in 1999.
Wow, that's incredible. I just remember, I mean, movie phone was like such a part of my like young college life because we would call to figure out what movies to go to. Like, wow,
that's right. It was movie phone. I always like to say movie phone was the internet before there was an internet. You know, if you think about it, going back to the late 80s, it was, you know, it was a essentially an e-commerce advertising supported media property. It was just only available through touchtone phones. And really, really interesting experience of kind of building an internet business in the very early days of the internet, you know, within another company, but within an interactive company.
So you sell to AOL and then you're like, okay, now what do I do?
Well, I was ready at that point, or at least I felt like I was ready to start my own business. Of course, in retrospect, you know, at age 28 or 29 or whatever I was at the time, I didn't really know. I didn't know anything about anything, but
I'm going to go for this ride.
But I started a company in late 1999 called Return Path, which with the help of lots and lots and lots of other people and some great venture capital investors, we built over the course of 20 years into one of the market leaders in the email marketing space. So from 1999 until we sold the company in 2019, Return Path was about $100 million business. It was profitable. We had 500 people all over the world and really built a great brand in email marketing, technology, and security. And then last year in 2020, a group of my colleagues and I from Return Path decided we wanted to work together again, but sort of apply everything that we had learned about building and scaling a technology and service-oriented business to a new space, and we started Bolster. So Bolster is not quite 1 year old. So Bolster is a talent marketplace, and what that means, like other marketplaces, like you know, Airbnb or Goat or pick your marketplace. We have buyers and sellers that come together. The buyers in our marketplace are CEOs of generally of private venture-backed companies, some tech, mostly tech, but not all tech, but companies that are typically from zero in revenue up to about 100 or 150 million in revenue. And then the other side of the marketplace, the sort of supply side of the marketplace, is executives. So we're creating a marketplace for early stage companies to match up with executives for a few really specific purposes. One is sort of coaching or advisory or mentor kinds of roles. Two would be consulting, executive consulting gigs. So that could be anything from a project to a role as a part-time or fractional executive or an interim executive, but all sort of on a consulting basis. And then finally, for independent board seats. So we have a really significant focus, as you mentioned up front, on helping match venture-backed companies with amazingly talented executives to join their boards. Within all of that, we have a real focus on helping the world of startup CEOs think differently about talent, whether it's engaging people as mentors or consultants, and you know, sort of not necessarily the full-time model, to connecting with a more diverse audience to build out and scale their boards of directors. That's really what Bolster is all about.
Awesome. So we'll go back to Bolster in a second, but like, how does one run a company that's venture-backed for 20 years?
Very good question. It's as my dad would always say, it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. Return Path was unusual. Most venture-backed companies don't last 20 years as independent and private. We had a very good run. It was not linear. It's not like, a straight line up and to the right. We had, some good years and some bad years and some pivots along the way. I'm really proud of the work that our team did, building a great brand in the marketing technology space, and a really strong business. And, at the end we had over 4,000, customers using our products to make their email, programs work better.
Awesome. And then I think from a founder perspective, when do you know it's time to sell and walk away?
Oh, I don't know that there's any magic to that. Most people can answer that question in retrospect much better than they can in the moment. I think for us, we had a number of people who had been interested in acquiring ReturnPath over the years. And we never quite felt like it was the right time. We always felt like, we had a lot more to do and a lot more to prove. We got to a point after, 17 or 18 years where we said, we've built a great business and a great franchise here and we can keep doing it, but we'd really have to reinvent the business at this point in order to think about, how to make it a $200, $300, $400 million business. At that point, our investors had been in it with us for a long time. I think they were probably a little ready to move on. They didn't push us too hard, but they were probably starting to get a little tired. Our team had largely been working on the same problem space for a long time. And our business had grown. It was nicely profitable. We had, great customer reach, the right buyer came along at the right time.
Awesome. I think that's a thing for a lot of founders, like, when do you know? And there is no magic formula. It's just like, things kind of have to be in the right place at the right time for you to make that move. And then, one of the things I heard is that, like, you guys had such an amazing culture at ReturnPath. Like, how does one build a culture that where, like, you can get people who want to stay on the ride for so long?
We were absolutely obsessed as a management team with being the best place to work. And we had that bug going back to the founding of the business. And I always used to say that it was as if we had two missions. We had a mission to, help people with their email and, make the email ecosystem safer and better and more effective. And then we had a mission to be the world's best workplace. And so we were very deliberate about that. We were very intentional about every decision we made along the way. We truly believed in the principle of people first, and that if we invested in our people, if we created a great place to work, if we allowed people a significant amount of freedom and flexibility, that we would attract and retain the absolute best workforce. That if we did that and we got that right, we would build great products and have great service, and therefore we would really do right by our customers as kind of our second constituency. And that if we did that right, we would have happy shareholders at the end because we would have built a great business. And that philosophy really served us well for a very long period of time. And I think was really, if not the secret, then certainly one of a very small number of secrets to the success of the business and also the longevity of the business.
Awesome. But it's so simple, but yet so many people just don't do that. And it's from the founders on down, as opposed to like magically this happening with ground up. It's like if it doesn't emanate from the top, then how are you going to actually build a culture that people want to stay in and be a part of that family?
Well, it certainly, I think, starts from the founder or founders or the early team. But at some point, you can't scale a culture and you can't scale values on your own in a top-down way. And I remember along the way at some point we had a real pivot point, probably somewhere around 100 employees, where we went from me and a couple of us feeling like we were the stewards of the culture to everybody in the company being a steward of the culture. And it just became self-reinforcing at some point.
Awesome. So cool. So like, so now with Bolster. So obviously, you know, there's been tons of talk around the diversity on board seats. I know California has mandated a rule that at least one woman has to be on a board going forward. So how are you all sort of trying to tap in and help create inclusive spaces where people of, you know, all different backgrounds will want to be on these boards?
Well, it starts by creating the opportunities. And what I'm finding as I'm working with our clients, and we have now over 600 venture-backed CEOs who are clients. Not all of them are doing board searches, but it's a pretty good number. And what I'm finding is that the challenge with startup boards is that startup CEOs typically don't have a lot of experience in board building, right? It's likely their first company. Therefore, it's likely their first board. And they don't necessarily think about it the way they think about other things like building out their leadership team or building product or working with customers. So the first thing that we do is we spend a lot of time with our clients talking to them about, you know, what kind of board do you want? How do you think about your board? How do you think about, you know, building it and getting as much as you can out of it? And with early stage companies, there are really three kinds of board members. There are management or founders who are on the board. There are investors who are on the board. So when venture capital firms invest in a company, they write into the deal that they get one or more board seats. And then there are independent directors, and that just means they're neither management nor investor. And it's very easy to fill up a board with founders and investors because those people are there demanding board seats. But in many, many companies, they have no independent directors at all. Maybe they have something in their charter or their bylaws saying that they can have one, but there's no one sort of asking for that seat. So the first thing we spend some time doing with our clients is making sure that they understand the value of having independent directors and why that makes them a better company, a better management team, a better CEO. Once we've done that, we then start the conversation with our clients about what kind of person do you want on your board? And the conversation almost always goes something like this. The first thing they'll say is, well, you know, for board of directors, I really want an experienced CEO. I want someone who's been a CEO. I want someone who's been a board member at a bunch of places. And, you know, that kind of makes sense logically, right? If you're going to hire someone to do the job of being on a board, you want someone that knows what they're doing. And then the second thing that they'll say is, oh, and it's really important to me that we have a more diverse board because our founders and investors, are all white dudes. And, you know, I'd love to have women on the board, or I'd love to have, people of color, underrepresented talent on the board. But they have to have been a board member somewhere before. And that's usually where we kind of pause the conversation. And say, well, look, you know, one of the challenges with the lack of board diversity in America is that there aren't a tremendous number of board seats that are occupied by women and people of color. And if you're going to insist that, we find you an experienced board member, meaning someone who's been on boards before, you need to let us open up the top of the funnel a little bit. Mm-hmm. And we end up in a good conversation, a very productive conversation, where so far, I think 100% of the clients that we've worked with on board searches have said, okay, I get it. I understand what you're talking about. And we then have a conversation about what it means to be board ready. And being board ready is different than I have served on multiple corporate boards. It's different than I have been a CEO. So we try to target our board searches, and we target a lot of the way we build our membership base at Bolster on finding incredibly talented executives from all walks of life, different experiences, different backgrounds, different demographics, who are qualified senior executives. And if they haven't been on a corporate board, a huge number of them have been on a nonprofit board. They've been on the board of a community organization. They've been on an advisory board, or they've reported to a founder or a CEO, and they've presented to a board. They've been engaged with a board. And we define all of those things as making someone ready to be on a board, board ready. So that's really the formula that we've had working with our clients for sort of opening up the top of the funnel to some amazing diverse talent and starting to populate boards with a bunch of really qualified people, but, you know, people who have not been CEOs or who have not been on corporate boards so far.
Awesome. And, this is a thing that is, near and dear to my heart as someone who, wants to sit on boards, thinks is pretty much board ready, has been on a bunch of nonprofit boards. And, we have we have a non-traditional background. So it's like, I've been a CEO for 10 years. I haven't raised any money, but I've had millions of dollars go through our accounts, and I think, what that looks like from a startup CEO universe is different than the world we live in today. Because there are so many people who are hybrids, who have come from different, business backgrounds, and can provide a lot of really unique sensibilities, but also here's how you can solve this problem. That kind of really great problem solving ability that can oftentimes not be found in a CEO because this is new for them. And so that kind of guidance is necessary. So, having board members who have diverse experiences, who've been down a lot of different unique rabbit holes, is an asset in terms of having those folks sitting on your board.
Without question, with boards, and I think this is the thing that a lot of startup CEOs don't necessarily think about. The sort of governance and oversight portion of work that happens on a startup board is very small. The governance and oversight work on a giant public company board, a Fortune 500 board, is very large. So I can certainly understand for companies that are billions and billions of dollars in revenue with public shareholders wanting to make sure that the people they put on the board have experience on boards. For startup boards, the work is all strategy and strategic advice, being a sounding board, helping make connections and introductions, helping someone navigate problems that they haven't seen before. You don't have to have been on a board for that. You just have to have been a smart and, well-seasoned executive.
Yeah. And I think, I have a lot of friends in the industry who are like, I don't think I'm ready for sitting on a board. And I'm like, so you've run $1 billion P&L and you also are the person who knows how to solve a problem really quickly by making a couple of phone calls because you have a massive network. Yeah, that's what folks need at this particular juncture.
Oh my gosh, do me a favor. The next time you run across someone like that, please send them to me.
You're gonna get some emails now. Don't worry. I got friends everywhere. And I think there's a lot of weird kind of stigma around what a board is supposed to look like. And then I think the flip side is it's like helping folks understand that you actually are board ready. You've done this work and time for you to sort of help and guide folks. But it's not just only the board seats that you guys are also helping folks, become fractional CMOs who can come in and provide guidance for companies too, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's board seats, it's advisor and coach and mentor roles, and then it's sort of fractional and interim executive roles. So we have a lot of people in our network who are basically career consultants, right? They do project work and fractional work, But we also have plenty of people who are fully employed and want to either be on a board or at least be in a position where they can advise and mentor not just CEOs, but anyone on a leadership team of a startup. So, you know, the flip side of that is all these startups we work with, it's not just their CEOs that need help, it's their CXOs that need help, right? It's the first time marketing director. It's the first time HR manager who would really benefit from, you know, some advice and mentorship from someone more experienced in that discipline.
It's absolutely true. And the thing is, because like you see, you know, in my line of work, I oftentimes see clearly there was nobody at the table to be like, you know what happens in the real world? Why this is actually not going to really work for normal human beings? Because everybody here is either someone who has been so deep in tech, comes from a degree of privilege that normal conversations don't actually make sense. And so when and then you see the app launch, you're like, oh my God, what are you thinking? Like my favorite one, you know, there was the company called Bodega that launched, you know, several years ago. And it was, you know, these two ex-Googlers, they raised a bunch of great money. And basically what Bodega was a vending machine that functioned like what they thought a Bodega was. And obviously then the minute it came out, it got trashed everywhere. And they were like, well, we had no idea that the reference using the name Bodega would somehow confuse folks and not, and, you know, or be detrimental to, you know, different communities. And my thought process was like, so you guys were able to raise all this money and there was nobody on your board who went, you know what? We should probably just take a step back because what we're doing here versus the communities that have bodegas and what this looks like is not going to be there for a long haul. Like, how are we going to actually scale for business when, like, we're automatically going to tick a bunch of people off on day one? And, you know, and that's not to know the internal workings, but like, it's one of those programs where it's like, if there had been someone there who, again, had been senior, because it's not just about finding people who are diverse, who can kind of tell you what things are, but really can talk from a business standpoint, from a P&L, from a marketing standpoint, that like, yeah, actually, historically, this is not a thing we should be talking about. Like, you know, taking the people away from a bodega and making it a vending machine is antithetical to this thing called a bodega. Right. You can't do that. Like, literally, you can't do that. But kind of, and came with that kind of counsel, it probably wouldn't have happened. And, like, you know, they no longer exist. You know, they raised a bunch of money and then, like, crash and burn. And it's because on day one, and they ended up changing the name, and it still didn't matter because the damage had already been done. Right. And so it's like, you know, it's very much the understanding that, like, you know, people who represent different aspects of diversity, so age, race, gender, neurodiversity, location, accessibility are all necessary because you want the people who can, one, talk about this stuff from a business standpoint, who can also kind of give you the reflection of where we are from a cultural standpoint. And if you have that stuff, again, early on, and it's, you know, within the veins in the company, then you don't need a transfusion when something terrible happens.
That's right.
So
that's right. Now,
it's key.
There's the old adage that it's, you know, the smart person learns from their own experiences and mistakes, and the wise person learns from the experience and mistakes of others.
Absolutely. Because, like, we've all been there. We've all made those mistakes. And so giving folks, you know, a point of reference in the real world is just key. And I think, you know, we see a lot of these startups who raise lots of money because, like, it's like, oh, it's like the new hot thing. And, like, hey, like, you know, you've got these, like, celebrity investors who are coming on board. But the ones who have the staying power have done the you can definitely tell the thoughtfulness has been there from the very beginning to build and to scale appropriately and to cast a wide net to get the most customers. So it's like having that board diversity is so key, especially at this moment that we're in right now.
Absolutely.
So, you know, thinking back on like all the work that you've been able to do, you know, talk to me about a time you had a challenge where you're like, there's no way we're going to figure this out. And then you did. every day, I know.
every day for sure. You know, I think at ReturnPath, which again was a 20-year build, one of the biggest challenges that we faced, you know, really in the history of the business, came somewhere around, I want to say, like year 15 or year 16, and we realized that our technology, our platform, had really gotten old, our team was spending increasing amounts of time fixing, maintaining, dealing with this enormous pile of what we call technical debt, to the point where it was really just choking our ability to innovate. And in order to keep our customers happy and keep growing as a business, we had to be innovative. And we were just working with old technology and old stack. It was, you know, hard to keep engineers excited about, you know, writing in languages that were, you know, 15, 20 years old. And it was really unclear sort of how we were going to dig ourselves out of it. And my CTO and head of product, Sean, who's now one of my co-founders at Bolster, you know, I think he said at some point that the hole was deeper and the ladder was shorter than he realized. And he led, and I give him a lot of credit for it, he led a very courageous effort and, you know, a decision that we had to make as a leadership team and ultimately as a board, to reinvent our platform. And, you know, I think at the time we were probably in, you know, still $80 million revenue business with thousands of customers. And, you know, we embarked on this 2-year effort that he labeled "slow down to speed up." It was a very tough call. We basically had to say, look, you know, we said to the market facing teams, the sales team, the marketing team, you know, we can't produce any new features for the most part, like nothing that clients are asking for quite a while now. Because we have to spend a bunch of time reinventing who we are, reinventing the technology underneath the business. But on the other side of that, we're going to be able to start a much faster pace of innovation than we've seen in the last 10 years. So it required the organization to kind of hold its breath and take a little bit of a leap of faith for what was already a fairly mature and sizable company, at least for, you know, as far as tech startups and scale-ups go. And it worked incredibly well. It worked faster than we thought. The product team was able to sequence things in such a way that we actually could start seeing some innovation and some new product development earlier than we thought. And it was the kind of thing we were so happy when we were on the other side of it. But, it just looked like this giant mountain to climb at the beginning of it. And we weren't sure we were going to be able to do it.
Awesome. So cool. But such an important lesson for folks: slow down to speed up. Like, you, sometimes that actually, you know, I think about that this year with, you know, our company, like, you know, for the last 9 years, I've been on a plane every single month, pretty much the entire time, going from event to event, to client to client. And this past year I had to literally stop because you couldn't fly,
right?
And our business had to radically change because we could no longer, we're in the people business, but there are no more people. You have to like stay home, and so it gave me a chance to really kind of think out, map out, and do the work that I, like, my previous life used to be, was like, I'm a strategist, building marketing campaigns. How do we reinvent ourselves as a different kinds of agency, but also provide far more lucrative services to our clients? Well, I was able to do that because I slowed down. I had time to think about what I wanted to do and the kinds of projects we wanted to work on, and start practicing what we preached. Like, hey, listen, like, actually, these are the kinds of projects that matter to us. These are things that won't serve us. And so everything else, out the window it goes. And it's a tough lesson, because when you're in it, you're like, oh my God, what? But then when you get through, there's no turning back, because I think you just come back out invariably stronger.
For sure. No question about that.
So, you know, this past year, you guys decided to start a business in the middle of a pandemic. What has COVID affected the kind of work you've been able to do?
Well, I think I think this will prove in the end to have been a really good year to start a business. And I think that's true for a couple of reasons. One is, it was a good year to be heads down building something, mm-hmm. As opposed to you know, being out trying to sell something. And that's sort of a general statement, and nothing to do with our business. But you know, I think it was a good year to not have a lot of expectations other than to be, you know, sort of heads down and working on a build. But I think the you know, specific to our business, it actually was a good year to start a business that encourages companies to rethink the way they use talent. Because a lot of people were thinking differently about talent this year. And whether they were shrinking or growing or shrinking and then growing, the message we have around more diverse talent and fractional talent and advisory talent really, really resonated. But I think the other thing, and this, I guess this is more on my first point about, you know, sort of being good timing for starting a business. I think people were able to work very productively this year. I don't know that that's could be true forever. And there are certainly some drawbacks to working from home, depending on who you are and where you live and how old your kids are, if you have kids. You know, if you think about all the amount of time, it sounds like you had the same kind of work pace that I used to have. I used to get on a plane every week somewhere for years and years. And as our prior company got bigger, a lot of the trips were overseas, not just in mm-hmm. the U.S. You know, I have probably an hour each way commute into the city from my house. And all that time, we got back.
Exactly.
And, you know, and we're able to really, you know, sort of channel it into either self or family or work. But I think people were just much more, you know, heads down and efficient this year.
And it comes in super handy. This comes in super handy. You know, what do you think you'd probably tell 25-year-old Matt?
Oh, 25-year-old Matt who didn't know anything about anything. you know, I would say probably, you know, something that took me a few years to learn and work in the work world was help others succeed first. And well, you know, I think that's true. And a lot of people would sort of get that once you're a manager or a leader, right? You have to, the people on your team have to be successful in order for you to be successful.
Right.
I think that's true for anybody. It's true for entry-level individual contributors that you want to be successful, but help others be successful too. And it's just it's a much better way to go through life. You know, in terms of one's own psyche. But it's also, you know, sort of a very healthy way to build a career and build relationships and build a network.
Awesome. Great advice. So you're at home after being on the road for years, starting a new thing. What do you do for your self-care?
Well, there's some things that I do that I've always done. And then there's some things that are kind of new features this year that I'm really liking. For example, I've always gotten up very early in the morning to exercise and exercise almost every day. But you know, when I was doing that and then commuting into the city, I was getting up in the fours. That's really early.
That's really early.
you know, I'm now able to do that and get up in the fives. And that's still early, but it's
you get the hour back.
A little more rational. So I always get up early. I exercise almost every day. I try to read kind of a balanced diet of things. And what I mean by that is, you know, a mixture of news and different types of news, different viewpoints of news, and mixed with fiction and nonfiction. I always try to have some things that I'm doing outside of work, you know, some form of a hobby just to keep different parts of my brain active. And the thing that's really been great about this year is I've gotten to spend much more time with my kids. My kids are at a great age. Every age is a great age, but my kids are 12, 13, and 14. And, you know, the last 10 years, I'm probably lucky if I've had 5 meals a week with my family. And now I have 3 meals a day with them. And I just love it. I love being, you know, much more present at home and in their lives. And, you know, when all this is over, as much as it's going to be over, there's some things that, you know, everyone's going to want to try to figure out how to retain out of new pathways they've forged over the last year. And that's one of them for me.
Awesome. And so important. It's like, you know, it's like we have the gift of time. That's been the biggest thing. I think as difficult as year has been, it's like, we can do so much more with this time. And as being like, this pendulum will swing back the other way. It's like, what do we do to make sure that we keep those things that we've learned over this past year? And that's one, how do we keep that time that we got back and not throw it back out into the wind? So here's hoping that we all do.
Yes.
Last question for you.
Yes.
Do you have a give and or an ask of the audience?
I do. I have a give and an ask that go together.
Awesome.
And maybe a second ask, but the main give and ask go together. The ask is, the first ask is, I would love for executives who are listening to this to join Bolster. And that's very easy. Go to bolster.com and click become a member. It takes about 5 minutes to join. It's free. As long as you're sort of, you know, qualified senior executive, you'll immediately be eligible to be matched for any of the searches that we're doing for our clients, whether it's for a board role or advisory or consulting. The give is for people who are listening and kind of wondering, hey, what do I have to do to get a board seat and how does that whole thing work? We wrote an ebook, which you can download for free, that is called How to Succeed in Your First Board Role. And you can get it at bit.ly, which is bit.ly/bolsterboards. So again, that's bit.ly/bolsterboards. And that is available for anyone to download for free and take a look at.
Awesome. You had one more ask?
I have another ask, which is if this is interesting to you, my team and I wrote a book, which is getting published by Wiley and Sons in May, and it actually just got put up on Amazon this week for pre-order. So if it's interesting to you and you want to pre-order it, you can take a look. The book is called Startup CXO. It's a book about how to be an executive in a startup. There are about 15 or 20 chapters on each function, how to be a startup CFO, how to be a startup head of HR, head of sales, head of product, head of technology, business development, et cetera. So a little something for everyone if you want a really good insight into how not just your functional executive role looks, but how it fits with all the other ones in an organization.
Awesome. We'll throw all that in the show notes. That's fantastic. I mean, and a must read, because I think there are so many startup founders who missed about a lot of things. So having it sort of in paper for folks to actually read or on their Kindle, I think is always important. So that's awesome. So we'll absolutely put all of that in the show notes as well. If senior execs who are listening can definitely create their profile. I've created mine. It's been really interesting so far, learning about the platform, and I'm psyched to someday, you know, have a really awesome board seat somewhere. So I'm going to vouch for Bolster. So Matt, it was so nice to have you on the show. Like you get it. And it's so refreshing to have an exec who gets it and wants to and solve some of these problems. So thank you so much.
Laura, thanks for having me. And it was nice talking to you.
Likewise. And that is our show.